Well, today is May 4th, 2009, and you're inside the Opium Den. We're getting ready to call Ethan Nadelman, the Executive Director of the Drug Policy Alliance. Ethan is going to bring us up to date on what's going on in the world of drug policy. So we're going to give Ethan a call right now and get him on the line and see what's up with Mr. Nadelman.
Hi.
Hey, hello, Ethan.
Hi.
Daniel Williams here. Welcome to the Opium Den.
Thank you. Good to be on.
Well, we appreciate you taking the time today to speak with me and get this interview in our archives, and I'm sure people will enjoy it. So first off, I saw you on the Colbert Report on the 30th. That guy winds you up, doesn't he?
Well, you know, it's an honor to be on it. You know, your job is to play the straight man. You know, you hope to score a couple of points and to get your message across, which I think I managed to do both of those this time. I mean, that was the third time I've been on the show, and I feel like I'm beginning to get a little better at knowing what to expect.
Well, I think so, too. I've seen you each time you've been on there, and like I said, Colbert really tries to wind everybody up, and he seemed to took about 30 seconds or a minute or so to get you wound up, but you did a great job. I wanted to compliment you on that.
Yeah, well, thank you. I mean, I must admit, I don't watch the show all that often myself, but the people who do said that I seem to acquit myself fairly well on that thing. So, and it's fun, but it's nerve-wracking.
I'm sure it is. So tell us, Ethan, what's been going on with the Drug Policy Alliance and what's going on in your orbit?
Well, I mean, I'll tell you, the thing that is far and away the most exciting is the way the drug policy debate just seems to be opening up now. I mean, never I've seen in all the years I've been involved in this. And I think that's about a lot of things. I think it's about Mexico and all the violence there and people looking at this and saying this is a prohibition-related problem. You know, it's the Arizona Attorney General Terry Goddard saying we need to put marijuana legalization on the table because so much of the money that the Mexican gangsters are making is from that. It's the El Paso City Council, calling for a national debate about legalization. Once again, because of Mexico, it's the stuff that you hear from Congresswoman Loretta Sanchez in California, once again about Mexico and saying we need to put marijuana legalization on the table. So I think that's one piece of it. I think the second piece is the state budget deficits. That certainly helped us in New York, where we finally won a major victory on Rockefeller drug law reform last month, and the state budget deficit played some role in that. It's playing out in Virginia, New Jersey, and California, all around the country, where states are saying we can no longer afford to incarcerate so many people, we need to look for other ways. And then I think it's also Obama. I think it's both the fact of what he said during the campaign and the indications that he means to follow through now that he's in office. I think it's the general opening up. It's the sort of broader political environment, Daniel, in which, you know, people, all sorts of things are being talked about that people did not talk about for many years, if ever. It's the ways in which, you know, you'd open up the newspapers and you would never see the word trillion until this year. And in the same way, you know, we've never saw the words prohibition or decriminalization or legalization being bandied about, and now they're beginning to edge their way into mainstream discourse and reporting on the drug issue. It's what's happening in Congress. So there's so much going on that I think really bodes well, and we're DPA, we're doing our best to try to seize these opportunities both in the media and in the policy world.
Well, I tend to agree with you, Ethan, but I want to move back a little bit. You mentioned Mexico and the emphasis that marijuana is getting as it relates to Mexico. Do you really believe that marijuana is that big of a revenue stream?
Well, I don't think it is. I mean, when I hear people like the Arizona Attorney General and others say that the Mexican drug traffickers are getting half or more of the revenue, I don't know that that's right. But I'll tell you this. I'm glad they're saying it, because the fact that credible people in the mainstream, in the law enforcement community, are making that claim is good for stimulating the marijuana legalization debate in the United States. I mean, if you think about it, so long as the issue was about cocaine in Colombia or Bolivia or about heroin coming from Afghanistan, people can put forward the option of legalization, as I and you and many others have, as the best way to deal with this. But we're putting forward an option which only has the support of 10 or 15% of the public, and which most people hear as kind of an idea that maybe makes sense intellectually, but that's never going anywhere politically. But when you point to Mexico And when credible people say that we have a drug prohibition related violence problem there, and that one of the answers is legalization, and that in this case, alone among all of the cases, the legalization of marijuana can make a difference, and when the legalization of marijuana is now supported by 40% of Americans nationally and by 50% of Democrats and independents nationally and by a majority sometimes of some of the Western states, that means that legalization, taxing and regulating a illegal drug as partially an answer to an international or foreign domestic prohibition-related violence situation, it becomes real for the first time.
So I kind of get that you're okay with, I don't want to say misinformation about the issue, but at least whatever they're saying is getting the argument.
Exactly. Like I, for example, will never make that claim that more than half of the Mexican drug trafficking revenue is in there. What I'll do is I'll say, look, credible people like Terry Goddard or other people in law enforcement are saying this. I don't know if it's true or not, but given what they're saying, it's definitely time to be looking at the option of marijuana legalization in the United States. I think that Tom Amiano's bill, the state legislator right. in California who proposed the tax and regulate bill, one reason it had legs was because of what's going on in Mexico. He used it. Congresswoman Loretta Sanchez pointed to it. The media pointed to it. It wasn't just the state budget deficit. It wasn't just the change of opinion that was stimulated by medical marijuana in Prop 215. It was also the Mexico piece.
Do you think we might run the risk, though? This is what I've been thinking. If we emphasize the financial gain from regulating and controlling marijuana and tie that to a reduction in violence because there's so much money that the cartels make, do you think we would run the risk that let's make the assumption that we do regulate and control marijuana, both recreational use and medicinal use, and we don't see the revenues and we don't see the violence being curtailed as a result, do you think that there might be some blowback on that where the prohibitionists can say, see, we told you so?
Well, I'll tell you, I think that the analogy here is very much with the repeal of alcohol prohibition. You know, I mean, what happened there was very clearly the fact that law enforcement no longer was focusing on enforcing alcohol prohibition. What clearly happened was incoming revenue from the taxation of the legal sales of alcohol. So there were some hard criteria, just in the same way now that you know, California Normal or others are pointing to the growing amount of tax revenue that's coming from medical marijuana, and whether it's the city of Oakland or the state of California, they're beginning to earn some amounts of money from finding ways of taxing medical marijuana. I think that provides evidence that the public, that will definitely be there and that will satisfy the public. In terms of what happens with the violence, you know, I think, look, first of all, if in fact you remove marijuana from the criminal justice system, there will be some diminution of violence. You will no longer have what's going on with, you know, illegal grows in national forests with Mexican gangs. You'll no longer have some of the stuff happening elsewhere. So there will be a reduction of violence around the illegal marijuana trade. And beyond that, to the extent that the gangsters move into other areas of criminality, I think at least people will have become comfortable with the notion that controlling the stuff, treating it as legal, removing it from the prohibition system, taxing, regulating, are preferable to the old system of prohibition.
Well, if we were to move forward in that direction, what do you think about this? If the cartels lose that revenue stream from marijuana, is there a potentiality that they'll increase their distribution of narcotics to make up for that lost revenue, and that it could create a backlash of even greater violence?
Well, you know, I mean, the fact of the matter is that there's nothing that earns these guys as much money so easily as drug prohibition, as the illegality of drugs.
Right.
I mean, 10 years ago, 11 years ago, the UN estimated the global drug trade, illegal drug trade, was $400 billion a year, or 8%, or I think 7 or 8% of global trade.
Yeah, 8%.
And some people said that was kind of high. But still, the magnitude and the ease of this money, being involved in an illicit commodities market, nothing gets you money the way that does. So is it possible that, you know, that these guys would try to market more of other drugs? Yes, but, you know, in the end, we have pretty substantial evidence that there's not very much demand when push comes to shove for these drugs in the United States.
Which drugs are you speaking of?
I mean, heroin, cocaine. I mean, when people are asked in surveys, and, you know, take this with a big grain of salt, but when they're asked if they would use heroin or cocaine even if it were legal, you know, 99% of people say no.
Well, I think the heroin 99% is pretty accurate, but with our history of cocaine use and that the Americans consume 85% or roughly 85% of the world's cocaine production, I'm not so sure.
Yeah, no. My guess is that those cocaine numbers are inaccurate, and that the U.S. consumption of the U.S. share of the global market is probably been steadily diminishing for the last 15 or 20 years as other parts of the world become much more involved in consuming this drug. You know, the number of Americans involved in consuming cocaine, it's in the millions. It's not in the tens of millions. When it was in the tens of millions, most of those people were essentially yuppies and middle-class people who were consuming it in relatively moderate amounts. The number of people getting caught up in really serious addictive use has always been in the area of 1-2 million, not huge numbers. And also, Dion, keep in mind, when you talk about actually making a substance legal, if cocaine were to become legal, you got to jump back to the late 19th century to try to envision what that would be like. Most of the cocaine being consumed when it was legal or if it were legal would be in the forms of tonics, you know, teas, chewing gums, colas. I mean, Coca-Cola had cocaine in it until 1900. The demand to smoke cocaine, I don't think it's going to be very substantial.
I agree with you. I don't think there's that substantial amount of percentage-wise of smokers versus snorters, but I do think that in a legal and regulated market, cocaine maybe wouldn't surge in popularity, but I think that there would be a significant number of people who would use it as an alternative to, say, coffee, amphetamines.
Well, but exactly. If they were using cocaine as an alternative to coffee and consuming it in teas, in colas, in tonics, in chewing gums, what have you, the health risks of that are roughly the same as the health risks of consuming caffeinated beverages and products.
Right.
Right? So you're really talking about something which presents no serious health risk to the American public whatsoever. The health risk has to do with people who are snorting, injecting, and sometimes, I mean, smoking, injecting, and sometimes snorting this stuff, where some percentage of them get in trouble. But the number of Americans who actually want to do that, I mean, you know, look, I mean, to some extent, you're putting your finger on the $64,000 question in the whole bigger legalization debate, where there are people out there, as you know, sort of cultural conservatives who basically lack some faith in human nature and really believe that if cocaine were readily available, that tens of millions of people would be addicted to crack cocaine and snorting cocaine.
Well,
and there are a lot
horseshit,
of other people. Yeah. What's that?
I said, that's obviously horseshit, but that's their
belief.
Well,
but I mean, that's what a lot of people truly believe that. They think that if you were to remove the prohibition, that's what would happen, that tens of millions of Americans are being protected from becoming cocaine addicts, right, by prohibition. And then there's the whole range of other people, yourself, myself, and many others, who believe that if you remove the prohibition and simply had sensible regulations, or some libertarians believe even if you had no regulations at all, that the number of Americans who would actually succumb to cocaine addiction would be no more or only a little more than is currently the case today, and with dramatically fewer negative consequences because it would not be tied up with the whole criminal justice system.
Oh, I agree without question. My point was I think that cocaine poses less of a psychological threat or has less of a psychological barrier to use than say heroin or even smoking cocaine, and I'm not so sure it would be a bad idea. I mean, the coca bean futures would probably take a hit, but I'm not so sure it would be a bad idea if cocaine were able to be reintroduced as a stimulant in very mild doses in teas and
one of the models we put out there, slogans we put out there at one point was put the coca back in Coca-Cola. You know, I mean, why should that stuff just have caffeine in it? Why not, you know, why not allow it to have low potency coca-based product in it, as it did? Remember, nobody talked about a massive Coca-Cola addiction problem in America prior to 1900.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, so far as we know, there wasn't. So the fact of the matter is, I think that, and I actually wish that, you know, Evo Morales, the head of Bolivia, would be a little more aggressive in talking not just about coca and the chewing of the coca leaf, but talking about allowing and or reallowing coca and low potency, you know, coca-based products to be re-legitimized in global trade.
Yeah, he's speaking primarily from a localized viewpoint. I agree with you. I think he should be more more adamant, or at least more expansive, about producing these type of substances, colas, coffees, teas for export. I mean, it would certainly not harm their economy.
Yeah. And I'll tell you something, going back to the issue around heroin, I mean, I would make two points there, Daniel. The first one is that you now have a half dozen countries that have set up research projects, all of which have proved successful, that allow long-term heroin addicts to come to a clinic and obtain their drug from a legal source together with other sorts of helpful services rather than from the black market. I mean, the Swiss did it first, and then the Dutch and the Germans and the Spanish and the British, and now the Canadians have all done this. It's proved successful in every case. And I think it's easily time for the United States to be trying to do the same thing. I mean, we're at a point right now where Denmark may start to allow the prescription of heroin to people who have been addicted to street heroin, and they may just skip the research phase because they've argued that to actually do research at this point would be unethical given the substantial evidence from around the world that these programs help save lives, help get people past their addictions, help remove people from criminality and the black markets. The second point I would make with respect to heroin is it's one of these sort of big picture questions, which is that if one had to choose between the current world and, say, which the United States has, let's say, a million people, half a million or a million people who are consuming illegal heroin each day or frequently, with all of the black market and criminality and HIV and Hep C and all the other bad things that go along with the illegality of heroin, or take the alternative, which, let's say, double the number of people who were using heroin every day.
That's exactly where I was going.
Heroin,
that's exactly where I was going. Go, keep going.
Exactly.
On that.
Well, you got it. I mean, but who are not involved in the black market, not involved in criminality, not spreading HIV or Hep C, which would you choose? Which, for both the users themselves and their family and the broader society, Which is the greater harm? A million illegal heroin addicts or 2 million people legally dependent on heroin?
And you eliminate all the crime and everything associated with the black market.
Well,
I'd take 2 or 3 million heroin addicts and no crime tomorrow.
And remember also, it goes to the definition of addiction versus dependence.
Correct.
You know, my definition of addiction is that addiction equals dependence plus problems. And that when you can take somebody who's been dependent, when you're dependent on illegal heroin, that almost always qualifies as an addiction, because it means there's all the problems that are attendant to that, all the need to raise the extra money to support your habit, all the dealing with criminals, the black market behavior. When you can get your heroin from a clinic, and when you essentially become no different than a pain patient who's dependent on their daily dose of morphine or Dilaudid or Demerol or whatever, you basically transform a potentially deadly and dangerous addiction into a relatively non-deadly and non-dangerous dependence on a drug, which for many people can be managed in such a way that it does not disrupt the rest of their lives.
Well, Rush Limbaugh is a very good example. For 2.5 years, he was a stone-cold morphine junkie or synthetic morphine junkie, and nobody...
Right. And essentially what he was dependent upon was not so different than being dependent upon heroin. I mean, heroin's got this kind of scary image associated with it, but when you take heroin, it's transformed into morphine in the human body. It's essentially indistinguishable from other synthetic and non-synthetic opiate drugs that pain patients routinely use widely in America, and which the large majority of them consume in a responsible way, in ways that allow them to continue to work. What people don't understand really about heroin is that when, unlike cocaine, unlike alcohol, right, it's not like getting drunk. When you're dependent on an opiate drug, you oftentimes, once you stabilize your supply, stabilize your dose, you to some extent can remove that issue of drugs from your life and function even as you take that drug each day.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've known heroin addicts that had reasonable and ongoing access to heroin, and they really had no problems. They could function, maybe not on an extremely high level, but they functioned much better than alcoholics. I mean, a heroin addict by definition is a rather sedate individual, and they tend to be...
The experience in England from the 1920s to 1960s was you had hundreds, probably in fact thousands, of middle-class people who had become dependent for one reason or another on heroin, in their younger years. And these were people who would go to their doctor and get their daily prescription from the pharmacy or whatever of heroin, and sometimes even of cocaine as well. And these were people who continued to lead middle-class lives, continued to, you know, have babies, raise children, hold jobs, do all these sorts of things, as if they were no different than a pain patient. So that's hard for most Americans to believe because there's so much scariness and so much misinformation out there. But there's a lot of very powerful evidence, not that this is a desirable way to lead your life, but that, in fact, it's a tolerable way to lead your life.
And manageable.
That is not the same as being an alcoholic or a cocaine addict.
Yeah, what I find interesting, there's a significant disconnect in the American public. I speak to people where I live down here. We've got a lot of old people down here in Southwest Florida, and when I talk to them about all of their surgeries and the like, and they're talking about being on the morphine drip for, you know, 4 or 5 days, and then they get out of the hospital and they don't suffer any immediate or long-term consequence. And I tell them that basically you were a heroin addict for a starter kit for 4 or 5 yeah. days, and you were able to walk away from without any consequence. And that tends to make them think a little bit about, one, the inherent dangers of morphine and heroin, and two, their own ability to consume this drug without becoming dependent.
Yeah. Well, in fact, the evidence shows that the vast majority of people who have been prescribed powerful opiate drugs do not become addicted, do not become dependent. That when these things are properly prescribed, people manage them, and when the cause of the pain, the cause of the need for the opiate drug diminishes and removed as people's bodies heal, as their cancers go away, whatever, then in fact people get off those drugs. And that the withdrawal they go through is fairly benign.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Right? It's also worth, there's now, one of the things they found, both in the Canadian trials and in some others on the heroin maintenance, is that long-term illegal heroin users buying their drugs from the street cannot tell the difference between heroin and Dilaudid. And Dilaudid is widely prescribed as a pain drug. When you test other drugs, they can tell the difference between heroin and morphine. They can tell the difference between heroin and other drugs. But between heroin and Dilaudid, experienced heroin users cannot tell the difference. So that tells you both that maybe it'll be possible in America, even if the heroin thing is too controversial, to start allowing street heroin addicts to get Dilaudid from clinics, because that may be a way of diminishing the black market. But what it also tells you is that huge numbers of Americans are using a drug which is indistinguishable from heroin. They're using it to treat their pain, and the vast majority are having no problem as a result.
That's right. Now, you mentioned controversy, and I'm going to bring up a little controversy here. I recently had an article published in Opposing Views. It's an online commentary or comment and debate forum, and they asked me if I would write a piece about medical marijuana and whether or not it was the proper strategy to move the drug debate forward. And I took the position that medical marijuana, even though I think it has great efficacy and I understand it, and I think it's terrible that our government denies that, a proven medicine to those for whom it works. But my position was that if medical marijuana, or even recreational, let's just lump it in, legalizing marijuana, if and when that were to happen, my question is, and I've spoken to you and a number of other drug policy leaders, although you are the most prominent out there, about this focus on medical marijuana primarily, but just marijuana as a whole. If we finally win that argument, win that debate, and marijuana is normalized and regulated and controlled, and since we all believe that repealing drug prohibition across the board is really the end game, What drug do we champion next? What's our next move? I mean, we get marijuana, you know, on the board. What do we do next?
Well, you're talking about not just medical marijuana, but assuming that marijuana has been legalized?
Yeah, let's just say marijuana becomes, you know, recreational, medicinal, just marijuana becomes regulated, legalized, and controlled. And again,
yeah.
If we, what's our next drug?
I'll tell you, for me and for Drug Policy Alliance, we basically have three stated objectives. And the first one is to remove marijuana from the criminal justice system. And that means, you know, either taxing and regulating like alcohol, or at the very least going at least as far as the Dutch have, where the retail side is essentially treated as legal, even if the wholesale is not. But basically taxing and regulating, right? That's first.
Right.
That secondly, that the possession of any drug by an adult for their own personal use should not be a crime, should be legal, right?
That's what about the supplier of that drug, though?
Well, no, let me, that's what I'm saying. So, okay. So first one is about take marijuana, treat it like alcohol. Secondly, any drug that any adult should be allowed to legally possess and use that drug. It may have to be in private, right? And obviously, if you get behind the wheel of a car, but it'll be a risk, you'll be, you know, treated the same as you are, like when you're drunk driving, right?
Right, right?
But essentially, that should be legal. And that's about civil liberties, it's about human rights, and it's about, you know, proper allocation of police resources. And then the third issue is that when it comes to the production and distribution, that what we need to do is to move in the direction of removing as much as possible of this from the black market and trying to bring it above ground into a legal, regulated system. Right?
Don't you think the pharmaceutical companies would jump at the chance to be able to provide a worldwide or a global market in controlled substances?
I don't think they're going to jump. I think they're going to keep eyeing it cautiously until they see that until the moment is there for them.
Well, I mean, if we came to them and said, listen, you know, if Obama or whomever his representative goes to the pharmaceutical companies and said, listen, we want to eliminate the global black market in these drugs. They're impure, you know, everything that go along with that. Would you, speaking to the pharmaceutical companies, would you be willing to produce pharmaceutically pure drugs for a global regulated market?
Well, I mean, I think it really boils down. I mean, the heads of major multinational pharmaceutical companies are making judgment calls all the time, and it's that it's if they saw the profit for them, you know, they would say sure. But they have to weigh, you know, is the profit opportunity really there, and what are the costs for them in terms of bad PR and all this sort of stuff? So I think they're going to wait for their moment. You know, I mean, and also the question of whether they can make their money from it. I mean, one of the issues with for example, Marinol, you know, the oral THC pill versus whole marijuana, you know, is that Marinol was something that they could profit off of. It could be produced in a pharmaceutical pill form, whereas whole marijuana is something that's much harder for them to make money off of. And where, you know, you finally have a company like GW Pharmaceutical in the United Kingdom that's trying to find the way to do it. So I think they would. I see that issue for them as being, you know, way, I don't know how far, way down the road. But it goes to the issue, for example, right now there could be a powerful argument for not just the pharmaceutical companies, but also for the soft drink companies, the Coca-Colas, the Pepsi-Colas of the world, to get into looking at the issue of coca, right? Coca tonics, coca chewing gums, all this sort of stuff. I think that they'll do it once they see that the political climate has shifted enough that it's safe for them to do it. At this moment, I think their principal view is why bother? And if it were ever exposed, if we were ever exposed as even looking at this right now, we would take so much flack, it's not worth it. When the politics changes, that's when they'll be there.
Well, yeah, I mean, it would have to go hand in hand. If you want to change the policy, if you want to eliminate the global black market supply, then you're going to have to introduce another form of supply. So wouldn't it seem like it would have to go hand in hand, eliminating prohibition and having pharmaceutical companies be ready to step in and take over?
Well, I mean, there's a few things. The first of all, the other thing I would just say is that when we ask the question about how we move in the direction of removing the production and distribution from the black market into a legal regulated market, I tend to assume, and there was a piece I wrote about, you know, back Dale, you know, back in the early 90s, when I was still teaching at Princeton, I put together a working group on the future of drug use and alternatives to drug prohibition. Brought together all the, 18, wonderful scholars, academics, ranging from Andrew Weil and Sasha Shulgin to, Ernie Drucker and Harry Levine and Craig Reinerman and, I can reel off a whole range of other names, Marsha Rosenbaum, Lynn Zimmer, John Morgan, et cetera. And we tried to think through what would be the optimal legal regulatory approach to drugs. And part of what we came up with, and for those who want to read about this, there's an article called Thinking Seriously About Alternatives to Drug Prohibition in the journal Daedalus that came out in 1992, and it's on the drugpolicy.org website. But it basically said, if we get to the point where every adult in this country has a right to possess and also a right to obtain drugs of known potency, quality, and purity from a legally regulated source that is civilly liable for the quality of the drugs they're selling, then you try to think creatively about how to most accommodate that individual right to use and obtain this drug.
What's your opinion on that?
My view, well, I presented in there a model, and the model was, I guess we can go through it on your show right here. It's not that long. It basically is, assume that people have a right to possess and also a right to obtain.
Mm-hmm.
Assume at the same time that you want to respect the rights of communities, to restrict public sale, public consumption, all of this sort of stuff. Assume also that you want to, drive out as much of the criminal involvement and organized criminal involvement as possible, while at the same time respecting the concerns of people who are concerned about public health and what have you. Right? So how would you optimally balance that? And then what I said is, imagine what would be the minimalist model that could accommodate this, that would attain these objectives. And I said, okay, imagine that you had a single source, like a vitamin house. It could be anywhere. It could be in Iowa. It could be in Texas. It could be outside the borders of the United States. And that any adult in America would be allowed to contact that vitamin house by email, phone, whatever, and have up to a certain amount of drugs delivered to their home or their workplace or their hotel room or whatever, anywhere in America, right? It seems to me that the different states and localities could choose whether to allow public sale, whether public use, what have you. So Mississippi might be, for all intents, totally dry, except that anybody in Mississippi or visiting Mississippi would still have a right to obtain this drug and have it sent to their home or their hotel room or whatever and used in private. Nevada might decide that they not only could you order from this place, but they would allow it to be sold publicly, used publicly, what have you, right? So you'd have the same kind of local variety as we had after alcohol prohibition was repealed. It seems to me that such a model would have basically eliminate roughly 90% of the black market, that essentially people would turn to the legal source and they would prefer the legal source, and that you would still have black markets for people who couldn't wait 24 hours. You would still have the black markets for young people as you do with alcohol and cigarettes today, but they would not be as violent or dangerous as the illegal black markets, right? And that this would be a sort of model by which you would both respect community concerns and public health concerns, but at the same time drive out most of the criminal involvement and the bad drugs and the adulterated drugs and all of this stuff. Now, obviously, the model's not perfect, and there's issues about how you deal with age controls,
right,
and all sorts of things like that.
Wouldn't it be more streamlined to obtain these drugs where we obtain all of our legal drugs now from a pharmacist, to be able to go into Walgreens or CVS and buy these drugs behind the counter? Without prescription? I mean, wouldn't that streamline it?
It might be. And my view would be that a state or locality could easily vote and say, we want to allow these drugs to be made available through pharmacies as well, right? But to some extent, pharmacies don't always want to be involved in making available things that are for non-medical purposes. It's that whole issue of what role should doctors and pharmacies play when a drug is being used not just for medicinal purposes, but as alcohol or other products are used, for oftentimes non-quote-unquote medical purposes. So I would allow states and localities to do that if they wanted, but I would say at the national federal level, which is the key level we ultimately have to look at on this question in the United States, I would say imagine the minimalist model that you need for the nation as a whole, and then let the states and localities adapt around that.
Okay. Now, I want to move back just a little bit. I mentioned my article in Opposing Views. Some of the feedback, and I would say about 80% said I was being heartless and I was being unfair to medical marijuana patients. And I just, you know, I don't think they read the damn article. But what a couple of them said, and I want to discuss this with you. They said, "Listen, man, quit rocking the boat. Don't you understand Senator Jim Webb's commission that he's going to set up, the National Criminal Justice Commission Act of 2009? Don't you understand that? I mean, how fucking stupid are you? Don't you see that as Obama's Trojan horse here? And lay off." So I want to ask you, I mean, I took my lumps on that, but what's your thoughts on Webb's National Criminal Justice Commission Act?
I'll tell you, Dan. I mean, I've met with Webb now twice, a couple of days after the inauguration, and then in April when he was in New York. And I've talked with him and also with his staff and helped advise his staff, as some of my staff have as well, and a range of other people. I think that Jim Webb's decision to step out on this issue and to really point a finger at the problem of over-incarceration in America, or the problem of over-incarceration in America, and I think his growing understanding of the extent to which the drug war is driving that problem, I think that those are both fantastic developments. I think that he is really emerging as really our champion on Capitol Hill. I mean, we have many other people who are sympathetic and even maybe more radical in their views than he is, but nobody's showing the kind of willingness and commitment and courage that Senator Webb has. And the fact that he's from Virginia makes it all the more remarkable. With respect to his commission, I think his instinct is right that such a commission could play an important role. I am concerned about the possibility that this commission may land, even if it's approved by Congress and set up, I'm concerned about the possibility that it may be forced to come out in the end because of a consensus process with fairly weak conclusions. You know, the way the bill is drafted right now, it calls for an 11-member commission, five of whom are from the minority party, from the Republicans.
Right.
And so that means there may be, given the current partisanship, you know, a desire on the part of many of the Republicans to just kind of, not produce very much out of all of this. I mean, there's some fantastic Republicans. I mean, you look at George Shultz and William Buckley, now deceased, and Gary Johnson, New Mexico, and Tom Campbell, the senator, you know, the guy running, ran for the former congressman from California.
Right.
You look at Grover Norquist and
Well, look at Ron
David
Paul.
Keen.
I mean, he's the only elected
Ron
guy.
He should be on that
commission.
Exactly, but I think the chance that he would land up being on it is pretty damn slim. And so I'm concerned about how far the commission will go. And I also think that the great risk in this whole commission is that a lot of people, including Senator Webb and President Obama and others, who are pushing in the right direction, that they are too enamored of drug courts, and
right,
that they have bought in too much to the myth that treatment only works if it's backed by the force of the criminal sanction. So I'm very worried that we could land up with a commission recommendation that falls short of calling for decriminalization and harm reduction, and that embraces sort of coerced treatment as an alternative to incarceration in a way which proves to be two steps forward and three steps back, or maybe three steps forward and two steps back, but either way, not going nearly as far as it needs to.
I agree with you, and I had an interview with Chris Crane the other day, and we spoke at length about Webb's Commission Act, and I'm 59 years old. I've been around a long time. I've seen a lot of presidential commissions come and go, good ones, bad ones, but generally they're either a stall tactic or they come up with good recommendations and they're ignored. But the problem that I have, one of the problems I have, but I guess the most significant problem, is that this is going to be an 18-month long commission. It's not set up, it's not passed, so it's going to take another month or two for that. Then you got 18 months on top of that, and then you're going to have probably they disband within 60 days after their commission report. So we've got almost a 2-year time frame where almost 2 million Americans, mostly young Americans, will be arrested for the simple possession of marijuana and thrown into the criminal justice system.
Yeah,
Why can't Obama do something about marijuana in the interim?
Well, I'll tell you. First of all, I talked to Webb specifically about the issue of how long the commission would be, and I think he's ready to be flexible on that. I mean, he would just as soon it go faster. On the other hand, I also talked with Richard Bonney, who was the deputy staff director of the Schaefer Commission and the principal author of the reports that they put out back in the early 1970s, and who now is a very distinguished professor at the University of Virginia Law School. And his view was that for the commission to really do its work right, it needs to be a longer one, and it needs to have a staggered. It needs to, you know, the Schaefer Commission did not just produce one report. It produced a report on marijuana reform first, and then it followed up the following year with a broader report. So I think that may be a proper model. It may be that you want the Webb Commission to take even longer and do a more diligent job and have a more public process and public hearings. I think it's also important to realize that we don't need to wait for the commission recommendations to proceed with reform. I mean, I was very encouraged last week when a high-level Justice Department official came out and said, you know, the Obama administration supports getting rid of the crack powder disparity. And I think that for Attorney General Eric Holder, you know, my understanding is that he is very committed on this issue, at least of sentencing reform, and that he also is eager to move forward faster than the Webb Commission. So I think we're going to see things coming out of the Justice Department, out of the Obama administration, out of Congress, even as the Webb Commission is proceeding. I think with respect to marijuana, I really think that this is ultimately going to be an issue that's going to bubble up from the state and local level. It's very much analogous to alcohol prohibition, that Washington and even FDR, they did not lead on this issue. They followed. First, you needed you needed public opinion to turn overwhelmingly against alcohol prohibition. You needed the states and localities to repeal their own prohibition laws. And then at that point, FDR and even Herbert Hoover were saying, okay, enough, we got to repeal this. And I think when it comes to ending marijuana prohibition, I think the number one priority is moving public opinion from 40% up to 55 and 60% in favor of repealing marijuana prohibition. I think that getting the states to change their laws is going to be the second priority, and that only then will we see an administration in Washington. I hope it's still the Obama administration, really beginning to say, okay, it's time to do the right thing.
Don't you think, Ethan, when you're talking about the 40% and the 50% and reaching that tipping point, don't you believe that President Obama could have tremendous influence in that by just stating, you know, we have this commission, we think, you know, the marijuana laws at the base level are wrong. We're going to take marijuana out of Schedule 1, put it in Schedule 4, or just do something in this interim period. Don't you think he has the charisma? Don't you think he has the clout? And I know he has the time. I know they're saying, oh, he's got too much on his plate, but this could be a very simple thing. Don't you believe that President Obama could come out and make that argument and push that to the tipping point and get this thing going?
I think that Obama's in a position to do something assertive on the issues of medical marijuana and marijuana decrim, where you already have 65 to 70% of the public saying, we want change, and the thing is stuck in the political process. I think he can do that, and I wish he would do that.
Why do you think he's not?
Well, I think part of that is because he has so many things on the agenda right now, and some of these issues
are
complicated.
Secondly,
remember, he doesn't even have a drug czar in office yet. You know, he needs other people to be the stalking horse, people to run with this stuff. I was disappointed when Gil Kerlikowske, the incoming drug czar, did a little Q&A last week. The one issue, by and large, a lot of his comments were not that different than past drug czars, except on those areas where Obama had made new commitments on needle exchange, on crack powder sentencing reform, on medical marijuana, on public health thing. When Kerlikowske was asked about moving marijuana from Schedule 1 to Schedule 2, his answer was no. And I think that was a mistake.
Of course, cocaine's on Schedule 2. Cocaine
what?
Is Schedule 2.
Well, exactly. And I think
and marijuana is more dangerous than cocaine. I mean, how fucking delusional are these people, Ethan?
And I think given the fact that Obama has talked about putting science above politics,
right. There's
no scientific basis or evidentiary basis for keeping marijuana in Schedule 1. So I think that was the most outrageous misstatement on the part of Kerlikowske. It's going to be interesting when Kerlikowske comes in. I hope they move forward more assertively on medical marijuana. I think with respect to marijuana decrim, anything that the feds do is mostly going to be symbolic because that's overwhelmingly an issue of state and local enforcement. But when it comes to tax and regulate, I don't see it. I don't see Obama stepping out any more than, president stepped out on repealing alcohol prohibition or other really difficult social issues in America.
Okay. Here's a question on Obama now. Not on Obama, but, and I understand, I mean, there's a lot of subtleties, but then at the end, I don't understand because, again, over the next 2 years while Webb's commission does his thing, a couple of million people, young people, will be thrust into the criminal justice system and create that. So for those people, I don't think there's a lot of confidence, but we're getting close to the end. I know you gave me 45 minutes, and I really appreciate it. So I want to close up, first of all, by thanking you for taking the time. I really appreciate it, Ethan.
Well, it was my pleasure, Dale. Thank you for having me on. And I also want to say how much I appreciate the work that you've been doing as well.
Because, thank you.
You know, your book and your voice out there, I mean, the more the better, and you've been an articulate voice on this stuff. And the only way we're going to have change happen is by more and more people committing and speaking knowledgeably and articulately about this.
Well, here's my last question. Let's smoke a big bowl, figuratively here. Mm-hmm. And Ethan Nadelman is president for a day. What would you do? What would your prescription be for dealing with drug prohibition? How would you attack it? How would you address the public? And what would be your prescription?
Well, the difference between being president for a day and being, the omnipotent lord for a day, right? if I was, which one do you want me to answer? The realistic.
Well, I like the omnipotent lord thing. I think that's a good one.
The omnipotent lord would basically say, that the criminal justice system has to be pushed to the edges of dealing with drugs in America. That we need to, absolutely end the prohibition on anybody, on any adult possessing this drug or using them in the absence of harm to another human being, that we need to remove marijuana right away from the criminal justice system, and that we need to immediately take every step possible to try to pull the rest of this stuff out of the black market into the legal regulated market. I also think that the notion that the greatest protection we have against drug abuse is the educated consumer, we need to take that seriously. There are all sorts of ways, the notion that our fate should be entirely in the hands of doctors or the pharmaceutical companies, and that human beings should be infantilized and treated like children when it comes to dealing with drugs. Lots of people screw up on drugs, but lots of doctors screw up, and lots of pharmaceutical companies have a lot of interests that are other than reducing drug abuse. So I would say that we need to be much more innovative and thoughtful in terms of how we learn how to live with drugs in our society. I think the greatest obligation is to understand how much of our irresponsible drug policies are driven by fear and ignorance, and that the real key to leadership is trying to provide an antidote to that fear and ignorance in this area as in most others.
Ethan Nadelman, thanks for being in the Opium Den. You have one of the most common sense and wise voices out there. What you just gave is your prescription, I think, is very right on, and I'm hoping that you can continue to get in there with Jim Webb and all these other folks and rail against the machine, as they say. So
okay, well, Dale, thank you very, very much for having me on, and thank you for everything that you do.
Not a problem. Back at you, Ethan.
Okay.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Well, Ethan Nadelman, Executive Director of the Drug Policy Alliance, here inside the Opium Den. Hope you enjoyed it. Thank you very much, and until we speak again, stay healthy and high when it helps. Bye now.